Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do Chapter 27, Jewish Copper Kings Reap Rich War Profits, from The Unabridged, The International Jew by Henry Ford and his team of crack researchers, as they always say. Now, that's a cliche, and you always couple an adjective and a noun. So, part of being a writer, you want to vary that in order to keep people thinking and not simply gliding over the surface of it. So, anyway, this chapter will be a specific look at Jews and copper and the war and how they profiteered while their boy Bernard M. Baruch is running the war board, which is effectively powered by Congress with dictating how every bit of money and materiel and raw resources are used throughout the entire economy. So the Jews have access to all the trade secrets of everybody else and all the money secrets, and they know where all the flows are going. And this guy has the final say in how they're disposed during the wartime. Anyway, as you know, everything that we do is recorded at vnnforum.com. We style it part of our learning college. No debt, no drugs, no drunkenness, no debauchery, just good, solid, honest Aryan learning. What a novel concept. A college is a place to actually study and learn and think and reflect and compare notes with other people who are also doing the same thing, thinking, reflecting, and thereby sharpening other people. Okay, because you go to a car wash, you don't also have drinks and this and that and the other and go into debt. You go there to get your car washed. Or if it's a self-wash, to wash it yourself. The point of college is to study stuff, not for sex, drugs, rock and roll, and huge debt. Enough on that. Anyway, chapter 27 of 80, Jewish Copper Kings Reap Rich War Profits. With this article, we shall dismiss Mr. Bernard M. Baruch for the present. His activities are not by any means to be construed as the main effort of Judah in the United States, Judah being the all body of Jews. Nor is he himself to be regarded as an important factor in the Jewish world program, the protocols. Indeed, it is to be doubted that he has been entrusted with many of the secrets of the elders, but he has been found to be a useful man, willing to play the Jewish game with Jews, and consciously bound, as all Jews are, by an obligation to see that Jewish interests get the better of the balance whenever possible. Mr. Baruch, of course, is much pleased with the role he was permitted to play in the government of the United States during the war, but he probably has sense enough to know that he was chosen for other than mere personal reasons. Indeed, one of the keys to the controlling part which a few Jews were permitted to play in American affairs during the war is to be found just here in the question, why was Mr. Baruch chosen? What had he been, what had he done, that he should have been chosen as head and front of governmental power in the war? So what they had was like a National Defense Council, and then they had six cabinet heads were in there, and then they had an advisory committee, and Baruch and some other Jews were some of the main players on that. But Baruch in particular was the head of the War Production Board, and he was the main man during World War I. And a lot of Jews got rich off of this, and that's what we're hearing a little about in today's segment. And the point that Ford was making last chapter is that, you know, how in the world do they come to have this absolutely dispositive power over the entire economy? This should be looked into by Washington. And I guess it was a little, but not enough in the end. But anyway, so he's saying, why was Baruch chosen? What was his background that he should have been chosen? His antecedents did not account for it. Neither his personal nor commercial attainments account for it. What does? There was no elected member of the United States government who was closer or even as close to the president during the war as was this Jew out of Wall Street. No one whom the people sent to represent them at Washington ever came within leagues of the privileges accorded to Mr. Baruch. Plainly, this is an unusual situation, not explainable by the emergency at all, certainly not explainable by anything that is as yet a matter of public knowledge. As one man out of many, altogether serving the country, Mr. Baruch, of course, would be perfectly explainable. But as the man, the man whose single committee was run up through the fabric of the Council of National Defense, which I mentioned earlier, until it formed the focus of the war government, he is not explainable. It was not only during the war, but also after the armistice, that these tokens of signal choice were showered upon Mr. Baruch. He went to the peace conference, resigning as chairman of the War Industries Board on December 31, 1918. Quote, I went down to my place in South Carolina and there received a wireless message from the president to come to Paris. I then went to Paris. I think I sailed about the 1st or 2nd of January. I know one vessel broke down and I had to transfer from one to the other, but I had no further activities in connection with the government, that is, the War Industries Board. Mr. Graham, how long were you in Paris? Mr. Baruch, I sailed, returning June 28th or 29th. I came back on the George Washington. This means that he was part of the president's entourage. What were you doing there, Mr. Baruch? I was an economic advisor connected with the peace mission. You stayed until the peace treaty was concluded. Again, this is all Graham and Baruch. Yes, sir. Did you frequently advise with the president while there? Whenever he asked my advice, I gave it. I had something to do with the reparation clauses. I was the American commissioner in charge of what they called the economic section. I was a member of the Supreme Economic Council in charge of raw materials. Did you sit in the council with the gentlemen who were negotiating the treaty? Yes, sir, sometimes. All except the meetings that were participated in by the Big Five, meaning the Big Five premier. And frequently those also, said Baruch. This, then, is a sidelight on what has been called a kosher conference. A name given to the peace conference by Frenchmen who were astounded to see thousands of Jews from all parts of the world appear in Paris as the chosen counselors of the rulers of the nations. Jews were so conspicuous in the American mission as to excite comment everywhere. A Persian representative left on record this protest. When the United States delegation accepted a brief for the Jews and imposed a Jewish semi-state on Romania and Poland, they were firm as the granite rock, and no amount of opposition, no future deterrence, made any impression on their will. Accordingly, they had their own way. But in the case of Persia, they lost the fight, although logic, humanity, justice, and the ordinances solemnly accepted by the great powers were all on their side. Well, that's interesting. So, the U.S. delegation was seen as completely Jews, and astonishingly to the French in the where the conference was held. And they had their way, imposed a Jewish semi-state on Romania and Poland. This is why people don't like Jews, and then they pretend that what they call anti-Semitism, a trick that we use, that we play, as one Jew has said, notably on videotape you can find on YouTube, is their pretense that the reaction to them comes out of nowhere and has nothing to do with their behavior, but is purely a matter of bad character on the part of those that they are basically persecuting and attacking and lying about and discriminating against. Their anti-Gentilism is far more pronounced than their love. They don't love themselves. They hate Gentiles. Anti-Gentilism, yet, is a word seldom seen, but it fits exactly what they think and how they act. Anti-Semitism is not real. It's simply a reaction, the natural reaction of all non-Jews to Jewish behavior, which is completely obnoxiously discriminatory against non-Jews. Anti-Gentilism, the Jews are the aggressor, and anti-Gentilism is how they feel about all non-Jews, and their religious code, so-called, defines non-Jews as basically livestock who are there to be used by Jews and discarded as necessary, and eventually all the goods of the world are supposed to fall into Jewish hands per their prophecy. That's what they believe, and that's how they act. And their anti-Gentilism is the driving force in the world, and particularly, I would say, their Lachsism, their hatred of whites in particular. Anyway, says Ford, this comment is rather humiliating, but it is true. The Jewish World Program was the only program that passed through the peace conference without hindrance or revision. So numerous and ubiquitous were the international Jews in Paris, so firmly established in the inner councils, that the keen observer, Dr. E.J. Dillon, whose book The Inside Story of the Peace Conference, Harper's, I guess it appeared in that magazine, or, well, no, he said it just said as a book, so I guess Harper's would be the publisher, is the best that has appeared. The keen observer, Dr. E.J. Dillon, whose book, The Inside Story of the Peace Conference, is the best that has appeared, was constrained to say this: "It may seem amazing to some readers, but it is nonetheless a fact that a considerable number of delegates believe that the real influences behind the Anglo-Saxon peoples were Semitic. Behind the Anglo-Saxon peoples, plural, were Semitic." And again, long block quote here from Dillon. "They confronted the president's proposal on the subject of religious inequality, and, in particular, the odd motive alleged for it, with the measures for the protection of minorities, which he subsequently imposed on the lesser states, and which had for their keynote to satisfy the Jewish elements in Eastern Europe." I guess he's talking about Romania and Poland here. "And they concluded that the sequence of expedients framed and enforced in this direction were inspired by the Jews, assembled in Paris for the purpose of realizing their carefully thought-out program, which they succeeded in having substantially executed. However right or wrong these delegates may have been, it would be a dangerous mistake to ignore their views, seeing that they have since become one of the permanent elements of the situation. The formula into which this policy was thrown by the members of the conference, whose countries it affected, and who regarded it as fatal to the peace of Eastern Europe, was this: henceforth, the world will be governed by Anglo-Saxon peoples, who in turn are swayed by their Jewish elements." Now that is extremely interesting. "The formula into which this policy was thrown by the members of the conference, whose countries it affected, and who regarded it as fatal to the peace of Eastern Europe, was this: henceforth, the world will be governed by the Anglo-Saxon peoples, who in turn are swayed by their Jewish elements." Now, how can you see that as not being descriptive today, 100 years later, of what goes on as our idiots run off to fight wars for the Jews in the Middle East, which used to be called the Near East, but nothing that concerns Israel can't be in the middle of things, because Jews are all important. They're God's people. Must be a pretty strange God, huh? Anyway, "there are other matters pertaining to Mr. Baruch which must await the development of this study, but it is worthwhile just now to possess ourselves of the information at hand regarding his peculiar handling of the copper situation during the war. Mr. Baruch is known as a copper man. Copper is Jewish. That metal, throughout the world, is under Jewish domination. The Guggenheims and the Lewisons, Lewisohns, two Jewish families, Guggenheims and Lewisons, are the copper kings of the planet. Not that they confine themselves to copper. For example, their output of silver throughout the world is 1/4 more than is produced in the entire United States. By his own testimony, Mr. Baruch was interested in copper concerns. What his holdings were during the war he did not disclose, but what his actions were has been very clearly set forth bit by bit in various inquiries. Before the United States entered the war, Mr. Baruch rounded up the copper kings. I went to New York and saw there Mr. John D. Ryan and Mr. Daniel Guggenheim," he said in his testimony. This was in February or March 1917, he wasn't sure which, but he said it was before we went into the war. Now, who were these gentlemen? Mr. Ryan was apparently in charge of the reorganized Lewison properties, while Mr. Guggenheim was chief of the seven Guggenheims who form, quote, a business family and a family business. They divided business during the war. The United Metals Selling Company, which sold the United States government its copper during the war, was the Lewison business reorganized, of which Tobias Wolfson was the vice president, and the American Smelting and Refining Company was, apparently, the Guggenheim interests. There was no competition between these two during the war. How did it come about that these two worked together? Their case is clear on paper. Their answer is that Mr. Baruch asked them to. And Mr. Baruch is clear, too. Was he not a government official, and did they not show patriotism in doing as the government official bade them? It came to this. The government made a rule that it would do business only through the American Metals Selling Company as the representative of the copper producers of the United States. This meant, of course, that if the few competitors of this Jewish copper combine were to do business with the government, they too had to make arrangements with the American Metals Selling Company. Mr. Graham, but how did it happen that you were representing the other companies who were your competitors? Mr. Wolfson, well, at the request of the War Industries Board, we offered a copper producers committee. Mr. Graham, who requested that? Mr. Wolfson, Mr. Eugene Meyer, Jr., representing Mr. B.M. Baruch. Mr. Graham, now let us find out who Mr. Eugene Meyer, Jr. was. Do you know him? It develops that Eugene Meyer, Jr. is another Wall Street man who, quote, had large investments in copper, unquote, though whether he retained them during the war, Mr. Wolfson did not know. Mr. Graham, quote, then Eugene Meyer, Jr. went into the War Industries Board, and he took up with the copper producers the question of furnishing copper, did he? Mr. Wolfson, yes, sir. As a result of that request, a meeting was held at 120 Broadway, at which were present, among a few others, S.S. Rosenstam, L. Vogelstein, Julius Loeb, T. Wolfson, G.W. Drucker, and Eugene Meyer, Jr. Mr. Graham, any Army officers there? Mr. Wolfson, no. The witness here quoted, Tobias Wolfson, was one of the most active instruments in the actual passage of the business, but the Washington representative was a Mr. Mosehauer. The interesting thing about Mr. Mosehauer, M-O-S-E-H-A-U-E-R, is that he represented both the American Metals Selling Company and the American Smelting and Refining Company, the Lewisons and the Guggenheims, and by order of Baruch, with the approval of the government, the business was done with these two corporations. How did they divide? It was very simple. Mr. Wolfson euphoniously describes it as a division of labor. The Lewison Group took the trade with the United States. The Guggenheim Group took over the business with the Allies, the foreign business with the Allies. Now, the next interesting point is the special committee through which Baruch's board dealt with the copper producers. This committee, representing the government, consisted of three persons: Pope Yeatman, chief; E.C. Thurston, assistant; Andrew Waltz, assistant. Pope Yeatman, Y-E-A-T-M-A-N, was a mining engineer employed by the Guggenheims at $100,000 a year. E.C. Thurston was Pope Yeatman's assistant in that private employment. Andrew Waltz was a consulting mining engineer for the Guggenheims. Some of these may be Goyim who were doing the actual engineering work. Everything was all set. The Jewish metal monopoly was assured of control on both sides of the Atlantic. It was perhaps thought desirable, in view of the bad political odor which had accompanied the copper power in several states, mostly in connection with the copper senators, like Clark of Nevada. Readers of this series will remember, in connection with the name of Guggenheim, that it was Senator Simon Guggenheim who fought against the census enumeration of Jews, as once proposed by the census officials, that something be done to gild the arrangement. It was apparently necessary to do something to disarm the protest that might arise against this thorough Judaizing of the war metals. Therefore, a very fine show of patriotism was made. This is worthy of notice in view of the show institutions mentioned in the protocols. The American public is becoming accustomed to these show institutions, proposals which promise everything and then fade away into nothingness. It is one of the most effective methods of destroying the morale of a people. When Mr. Baruch saw the heads of the two copper families, he says he found them willing to think of nothing but giving copper to the government. Money was of no consideration whatever. Mr. Baruch, they said that, so far as the United States government itself was concerned, they would give Uncle Sam all the copper he wanted for his preparedness campaign at any price that was decided upon. In order to arrive at some price, we took the average price for 10 years, which was about 16 2/3 cents, and that is how the price came to be arrived at. At the time that they said this, copper was selling somewhere around 32 and 35 cents a pound. There, then, was a magnanimous thing. The government was to be given copper at half the market price. But did the government get it at this price? Wait, the story is a good one. This unheard-of sacrifice of profits for patriotism was extensively advertised. The Secretary of the Council of National Defense wrote a stirring story for one of the best magazines, in which he said, Mr. Baruch first announced his presence in the tremendous task of mobilizing American industry by procuring 45 million pounds of copper for the Army and Navy at about half the current market price, saving the government in the neighborhood of $10 million. Mr. Baruch himself in his testimony expanded with the generosity of it all. In an apparent mood of help yourself to all you want, he said, "On inquiry, we found that the Army and Navy wanted only 45 million pounds, which used to be a lot of copper before we got to dealing in astronomical figures, and they were given all the opportunity to consider what they wanted. They could just as well have had 450 million pounds as 45 million pounds because there was an open offer. Now for the effect which this produced on the country at large." "The effect of that offer of the copper producers was electrical," said Mr. Baruch. "It showed that there was in this country a desire to set aside selfishness, so far as our government was concerned, in its need. Make us any price you want." In tweezers. So that was practically the attitude that the producers took. "But the government did not get the copper at that much advertised patriotic price. Mr. Graham, they did not pay 16 2/3 cents for the 45 million pounds. Mr. Baruch, oh no, not these other large quantities of materials." He said that the copper was furnished to the government without receiving money for it. Price fixing was yet in the future. Then we came to the point. Well, what about the civilian population? So we made it a rule that became a policy that whatever price was fixed, it should be for everybody. That was what was fair for the Army. That what was fair for the Army and Navy was fair for the civilian population. There seems to have been a rapid cooling of generosity under the prospect of colossal sales, and the upshot of it was that after all the hurrah, the government really paid about 27 cents. What these figures mean can be deduced from the fact that during the war, the government bought 592,258,674 pounds of copper. If the reader is not already staggered by the import of these facts, there remains one more for him to consider. After the armistice, the surplus copper was sold back to the copper producers. In April and May 1919, the American Metals Selling Company received from the United States government over 16,500,000 pounds of copper at a fraction over 15 cents. This was less than the boasted patriotic price of 16 2/3 cents at the beginning. Not counting what they had received from the government for the copper in the first place, their profits on the difference between the price they paid for the surplus copper and the price for which they sold it, again, were beyond counting. They're selling for 27, they're buying for 15. This is what occurred under the triple copper monarchy of the Baruchs, the Lewisons, and the Guggenheims, and their Jewish assistants and Gentile fronts. However, Gentile fronts were boldly dispensed with to a very large degree during the war. The real powers behind the throne themselves stood out and did not hesitate to set their own people at every crossroads along the line of war business. It is not to be supposed that the Baruch influence began or ceased with copper, nor with any of the multitudinous industrial powers which he possessed. A man like Baruch makes the most of such opportunities as were then his. In matters political, personal, and even military, there were many openings for the use of his influence, and well-informed people about Washington did not doubt his facility in these things. Once again, however, Mr. Baruch felt he was skating on thin ice with regard to the law. He had gone ahead in his own plan, but in such a way that he would exercise the power without taking the responsibility. This seems to have been a very clear ideal with him, power without responsibility. Everything was fixed. All the conditions within which every contract would have to be made were carefully determined, but Mr. Baruch never permitted himself or his board to make a contract. After having consulted with the numbers of his associates in business, an agreement was reached, and only then were the responsible officers of the government told, "Go ahead and make contracts." The officials took the responsibility, but the Baruch coterie made the conditions and then remained aloof. Even this plan, however, had a questionable aspect which came to trouble Mr. Baruch, and the manner in which he manipulated the matter shows either a very shrewd mind or else very shrewd advice. The latter undoubtedly went with the former. There were plenty of Jewish advisers about. "To begin with," Mr. Baruch says, "the members of that committee were picked out by myself. The industries did not pick them out." Which means, in fact, that Mr. Baruch picked out a group from a group that had previously been chosen by the producers although plainly Mr. Baruch was desirous of modifying this impression. And again, it is true that these great copper producers were on the committee, and I selected them because they were great men. Now, these men, as members of a government committee, were to all appearances selling to themselves as members of the government committee, and apparently buying from themselves as owners and controllers of the very great producing combinations. Not necessarily in any discreditable way, but in a very unusual way. So other people buying and selling are doing the same thing. They're on the committees, they're promoting the patriotism, they're hyping all this up. Oh, we're selling it for so cheap, but they're actually selling it at a much higher price than what they're admitting publicly, and then they're buying the surplus back at a very low price after the war. There's a lot of in-group dealing. It's just a handful of people who are basically rich Jews and just a few Gentiles aiding them who are on these war boards who are dealing within their own industries that they control and making sure that they come out of it very well in the end. In the face of this condition, Mr. Baruch had the coolness to say, "So you can see that the government was as much in the saddle as it was possible to be." The producer members of the committee, headed by Baruch, were the government, so far as this statement is concerned. Time and again it was shown that the responsible officials of the government were not even visible until this extra government had determined all the conditions. So the government is basically rubber stamping whatever this Jew and his fellow Jews decide to do. Mr. Garrett, did any troubles arise with the committee's growing out of the legal situation that you remember of? Mr. Baruch, the committees of the trade, especially some of those that I had asked to serve, were very much disturbed about their standing reference to the Sherman antitrust law. Is that what you refer to? Mr. Garrett, yes. Mr. Baruch, and also in regard to the Lever Act, L-E-V-E-R, on the point that, quote, no man could serve two masters. There was no basis for it because these men were not serving two masters. They did not make trades with themselves, but, with the instrumentality provided, carried out the government's wishes or orders or suggestions with reference to the particular industry which they represented. So the Jews do things, they're very punctilious. They observe the laws in the book and they formally follow them, but they're careful to preserve the appearance that what they're doing is fully legal and all these various things are separated and it's clean and there's no double dealing, but the reality is they're just dealing to themselves, basically. They're controlling this stuff. The instrumentality, quote-unquote, with which the copper men dealt, for example, was the American Metals Selling Company, which, together with the American Smelting and Refining Company, was represented at Washington by Mr. Mosehauer. The Special Copper Committee, composed of Guggenheim employees, did business pertaining to the instrumentality which carried on the business of the combined copper companies. It was dangerous. Some of the members seemed to have felt it before Mr. Baruch did. Mr. Baruch never seems to have questioned anything that he did. Why should he? He had more power than any other man in the war, and he had the most powerful and autocratic backing that a man ever had. But the others, the non-Jewish members, were thinking of the law. So Mr. Baruch solved it very nicely. He took the committees, comprising the same men, and had them named as committees of the United States Chamber of Commerce for their various industries, and although the process was not changed in the least, the legal aspect of it was changed. It was rather clever. It was typical. And after that, Mr. Baruch, who had previously insisted that he himself had picked those men and that the industries had not, thus clearly encouraging the inference that these men did not represent the industry side, but the government side of the matter, he now insists that they represented the industry. Jew going back and forth. Mr. Graham, you changed and took these advisory committees and had the National Chamber of Commerce reappoint them so that they were then direct representatives of the Chamber of Commerce and not of the officials of the United States or connected with any governmental machinery. Mr. Baruch, I never considered them officials of the government, Mr. Graham. Mr. Graham, they were as much officials of the government as the rest of you, were they not? I do not think so, after several questions. I asked them to serve so that when the government wanted anything, they could go to one small compact body rather than to send out to I do not know how many people, you see? Mr. Graham, let's see about that. They were serving under you, were they not? You were the head. I appointed them and asked them to do this so that I could have a compact body to deal with. You did not think for a minute that they were representing the government, but did you not think you were? I was doing the best I knew how. But you had authority to bring these men in, Mr. Baruch, and appoint them as committee men under you, and you did so. Surely, if they were representing anybody, it was the government, was it not? I do not think so. Am I right in assuming that you thought they represented the industries? Mr. Baruch, yes. A great deal, of course, can be overlooked in men who are working under stress and endeavoring to do things the best way. It does not follow that because a businessman serves the government in matters pertaining to his own business, he is necessarily dishonest. But so frequent is dishonesty under such conditions, or if not dishonesty, then a loss to the government because of divided interest, that laws have been framed to regulate such matters. These laws were on the books at the time. This is a fact, whatever else may be true, that copper made tens and hundreds of millions out of the war, and it is not at all inconceivable that if copper had not been so completely in control of the government operations of purchase, the profits might not have been so great, and the burdens which the people bore through taxation, high prices, and liberty bonds might not have been so heavy. So this would be a peculiar form of regulatory capture where the government, the industry, takes over because there's a huge incentive and they have the technical expertise. So it doesn't matter how it's formally set up. They are basically dealing to themselves and deciding what price they'll pay. And, of course, they come out on top and the public gets screwed. Mr. Baruch is but one illustration of the clustering of Jewry about the war machinery of the United States. If the Jews were the only people left in the U.S. who were able enough to be put in the important places of power, well and good, but if they were not, why were they there in such uniform and systematized control? It is a definite situation that is discussed. The thing is there and is unchangeably a matter of history. How can it be explained? And this is what's so amazing. I mean, they come here in large numbers after 1880, and they're completely running the economy by 1917, let's say. Pretty amazing stuff. So anyway, that will conclude Chapter 27, all about the Jews dominating copper and dominating the committees that are purchasing copper from the U.S. government, and seeing to it that they come out well on top and make tens of millions of dollars. And that cost, those profits are paid and borne by the public, the goyim, the suckers. So we are the ones who fight and pay for the wars. The Jews are the ones who set the agenda of the war and who war profit from it. The war is the harvest of the Jews, and this chapter was a good illustration of that long-known point. So anyway, that's Chapter 7. I'll be back again soon with Chapter 8. Thanks for listening to me. And as always, remember that you can find everything that we do at vnnforum.com.